Humans cannot improve all that much, but for tools currently it's quite difficult to find that the really high risk stuff. So they're quite good at relatively low risk. But it would help if you would systematically every new high risk exploit that has been there, if you make a detector and apply that for every future contract. And if you just keep doing that, then the probability of the same hack happening again will get lower and lower.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, GM, everyone. My name is Degachi, the host of Scraping Bits, and today I'm with Gerard.
Hello. Hi. Nice to meet you.
How's it going? Yeah. Nice to meet you too. Just kind of message you and jump straight into it.
Back from ETC, so looking forward to this.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to you as well. I think we should start off with some context of who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, so I'm currently doing a security review, security audits, and also generally interested in the entire space. So just checking out a lot of stuff and trying to understand what's going on is basically my goal, to understand stuff. That's what I like.
And how long have you been in Web3 for?
I don't know, 4 or 5 years or something.
And you've even taught it as a professor, right?
Yeah, well, not really as a professor, just as a teacher, but at the Hague University of Applied Sciences in the Netherlands. So that's close to where I live. So that's basically where I created a course about programming dApps. To be able to create that course, I dove into the entire space and architectures and Solidity and how everything fits together. So yeah, I realized that teaching is a super good way to understand everything. So
oh yeah, for sure.
I did it for a while, and then there was COVID, and then I didn't like it that much. So then I finally stopped.
And then what was kind of like the transition into getting into the Web3 security space? Because now you're working at Spearbit, right? But you're also doing C4 as well. So how did you kind of get into those things?
Yeah, so I created that course and then was just looking around thinking, well, what else I could do? And then I saw the C4 tweet, so that Katerina was starting. So I said, well, that sounds interesting, so I might do a bit of that. And then I participated in the first contest, and then I was, I think, number 4 or whatever. And then I continued participating in contest, and then I stayed around number 4 or 5. And well, more and more people participated, so that was pretty cool to stay at the top of the list.
Yeah, and you're currently ranked number 5 of all time on C4, which is quite impressive,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's still based on the first year that I did Katerina, and after that I stopped, although recently I did another one for Luxa.
Oh, right, and then you just kind of transitioned into full-time Spearbit, basically?
Yeah, so yeah, and then I didn't have time to do much else. That's why.
Yeah, I guess when you started C4 until like the end of your C4 career, quote-unquote, you found so many highs as well. So I guess what was your kind of methodology for finding these criticals? Or was it just looking around the whole code base and finding everything at once?
Yeah, my strategy then and what it still is, first to understand the entire code base. So understand it from everything of it and making drawings, how things fit together, and then just keep it resting in my mind. So I at least spend a couple of days on it. And then once you understand it fully and keep thinking about it and sleep over it, whatever. And then, for example, we're in the shower, whatever, and suddenly something pops up. Oh, that could be wrong, or I have to look at that part or whatever. So yeah, that's how I find the interesting stuff. And basically I have focused to find the interest, the high risk stuff, because in the meantime I've also find lots of low risk stuff, but my aim is to find the high risk stuff.
Got you. Is there like any specific methodology for that? Instead of just trying to understand the whole code base, do you go for the functions that interact with money first and skip everything else, or do you actually read every single line first and then go into it?
Yeah, but basically every single line. So yeah, a bit on the size of the project where I start, but sometimes I just look at what is the biggest contract and start over there, and then just start reading through it. And whatever I don't understand, I sidestep to first understand what's going on there. So then maybe dive into some other contracts or some other projects. So then I keep doing that until finally I've read every line and I understand every line.
And let's say the code base has no tests, documentation,
or even comments. How do you go about that? Do you have to understand a code base? Do you write your own notes, or is it all really mental model?
Yeah, I make lots of notes and drawings and whatever. First, I like to sort of get a high level appreciation of what the project does. So I look at the website and whatever to get a broad idea what it's doing. And then usually I dive into the code, and then later on also in the additional documentation. But usually I don't really look that much at the tests at all. So I want to stay as objective as possible and not be pushed in a certain direction.
When you're going through these code bases, you obviously know like patterns of previous exploits. So is there anything specific that you look for or take note of when you see it in a code base?
Yeah, well, I like to collect all kinds of attacks or even classes of attacks. So whenever I'm not auditing, I'm basically a lot of time scanning Twitter and whatever, just following up whatever is there, and security telegrams, and just constantly looking for classes of attacks and trying to understand them. And then usually I make like a small, I'd call it a POC of such a class, so that I can play with it a little bit and understand it completely. And then, of course, I also make a list of those attacks and I have them in my mind. So then whenever I see contracts, I try to see if that fits any of the attacks that I know.
Right. And basically putting them into like categories and writing your own custom proof of concepts, right?
Yeah.
What are like the most common ones you actually see as criticals? Are they really complex ones where you have to do flash loan to get a bunch of money first, and then, for example, re-entrancy, or go into price manipulation, price oracle manipulation?
Actually, most of the high risk stuff that I find usually are just simple mistakes in the code. So an oversight of the programmer, or maybe that they've copy-pasted something and made a mistake in that. Usually relatively silly mistakes. But to find them, you got to understand the entire code base to sort of see there's something wrong. So I've got an intuition. So if I read the code, then I have an intuition, well, there's something that doesn't feel quite right.
Right.
And then I dive into that further, and sometimes no issue, but sometimes there is an issue.
Right. So they're more of just like typos that you're finding in these pre-deployment contracts, right? It's not extremely complex attacks. It's more of just the really simple things that they've looked over.
Yeah, sort of.
Sort of?
Yeah, of course, they're also like the re-entrancy or the more complex stuff. But I usually try to the complex stuff, reduce that to the whatever the entry points. So what are entry points that can be abused? And then when I now find a specific entry point, a simpler one would be like only owner missing, what could be variations of that. And then if I find an entry point, then I try to think up of a proof of concept. So what would exploit that entry point? And then the proof of concept could be rather complex, but even then I try to keep it as simple as possible so that the project can understand what the real problem is.
And have you done like any on-chain kind of audits, so post-deployment?
A little bit, but not that much.
Because when you think of it, they're two different things. And if they deploy and they fix all these simple bugs, then you don't know what the post-deployment is going to be like most of the time because of the environment setup and how people interact with it. So I guess, do you account for that stuff as well? Like, do you initialize it in your proof of concepts and also look for those complex ones? Or is it more of just like static analysis in your brain, just seeing what the code is doing initially, instead of, okay, put in this context, what's actually possible?
Yeah, basically just in my brain. So I'm sort of, I think in my brain, sort of simulating what's going on and what could happen and how interactions with other stuff could happen.
Do you ever think of if there is an arbitrary address, external call, you can kind of create your own attack contract and then interact with it via that?
Yeah, that's always what I take in mind, what a contract could do, or if you call to an outside contract, that outside contract could have any function. If that's an attacker contract, it could have any function and could do anything. So yeah, but that's just what I sort of simulate in my head.
Yeah, and if it does do this, you know, external contract, how do you know what the scope is that could influence this contract with an external one, right? For example, if you know it's using Curve within the contract, there's your scope. But if it doesn't say that, how do you know what the scope is with external contracts?
Yeah, sometimes that there are specific inheritances. So then there are specific projects which they interact with. So then you know that. So then usually I look into those projects and see, well, what are the requirements for the interface? What are the limits? What you can do with it? And sometimes that also gives some bugs. And sometimes it's just a general call outside, which could be to any contract.
Right. Yeah,
and then I assume you can do anything from that contract and call back any other function and whatever.
Yeah, I'm quite interested in the ones that use an interface for an arbitrary address, because then you could basically copy that interface, but then also add an extra functionality within that function that it's inheriting. Kind of just like Pickle Finance, if you've seen that one or remember that one. They did like the custom jars and made it like an evil jar, which inherited the interface of the jars of Pickle. And then they had like their own exploit in the jars, even though it was an interface contract. Yeah, it was quite interesting. I wonder what's the biggest problems you face as an auditor are in both C4 and I guess in a more formalized sense in something like Spearbit.
Yeah, the biggest constraint basically is always time, I think. So there's so much that you could research and could do and could understand. That's always basically time limits.
Right. And what would be like the solution for that? If you could bring any tool basically into existence that would help you with that problem, what would you want it to do, I guess?
Yeah, well, for sure, tools can help to find whatever they can find is always good, as long as it doesn't give a lot of false positives, which sometimes is the case. And then reviewing the false positives takes so much time that it would be more efficient to not use the tool and just do it directly. So that's one thing. And tools that could help you understand the code better by making, for example, drawings of it or highlighting interesting things or whatever, that could also be useful, I guess.
So just kind of like telling you directly, okay, this function interacts with this other function. Oh, there's an external call here. This could be something interesting. Go explore it. Or maybe like a storage slot isn't updated, but is being used. Something like that.
Yeah, which is a function with only owner and which, for example, green, and these functions don't have only owner. So they are whatever orange, so that you have to double check them more.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff.
And why did you choose to get into something more formalized thing like Spearbit instead of just keep on going on Code4?
Basically because Code4 is doing it on your own mainly. So and with Spearbit is with a group, so that's also nice. And there are also a lot of other interesting people at Spearbit, especially like the founders Harry and Alex. And also the fed up people who are joining on audits. So that's also quite good to bounce off ideas. So if you have a hunch, then somebody else can make that into an exploit and the other way around.
So the benefits are really just bouncing ideas off of people and just learning from each other.
Yeah, so you always have to continue to learn.
And what is like the approach of auditing in a team versus solo or by yourself?
Yeah, so what we usually do is set up a GitHub repo and everybody puts in their comments so everybody else can see the comments of the others. And usually I make a first pass through the code and putting in my own comments without looking at comments of others, just to prevent to be confused by them. And then after I did that first pass, then I also start looking at the comments of others and then combining my findings with other findings and my findings on different places. So then combining it all together. And by the way, also the project team also has access to the GitHub. So we can also link a question to that and they answer that. And sometimes we say, well, this looks a bit fishy. And then they can say, oh, that's indeed an issue. Or that's not an issue at all because blah, blah, blah. So it also really helps.
So you basically just cross-check each other's notes and maybe you spark an idea from someone else's note and...
Yeah, sometimes I think there's an issue and then later on I think, oh, there's not an issue. So then I strike it through and then another fellow auditor sees it and he combines it with something else that he saw. And then he says, oh, it's an issue. So then it turns out to be an issue anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's the interesting stuff.
How did you really get into basically auditing? You didn't have any auditing background prior to...
Yeah, actually, I did. I used to be an IT auditor, so the like traditional way of auditing.
Okay, right. And then you just went into C4, then through C4 you found Spearbit, right?
Yeah. Also, I hadn't been doing IT audits for quite some time, but I still have the knowledge and the theory or whatever about it. So I thought at the moment, oh, I do know about Solidity and that kind of stuff, and I know about auditing, so I should be able to do security auditing for Solidity.
Yeah, just kind of transfer over. And what do you think are the main differences in, you know, Web2 and Web3 security? What are the differences comparing them?
Yeah, the more traditional audits that I did at banks and the types of organizations, they are more sort of usually high level, so more focused on procedures and logical access control and that kind of thing. While Web3 audits are far deeper into the nitty-gritty details. Mm. So that's quite a large difference about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's more thorough that way on the Web3 side. But on the Web3 side, it's more very narrow focused. So usually it's just only on the smart contracts, while within an entire project, maybe 90% of the code isn't smart contracts. And outside of the code itself, there's lots of procedures like change management, major incident management, whatever, lots of procedures and processes that are hardly ever touched by security audits.
Gotcha. Did you ever wonder or kind of touch base into the automated world of auditing, or is it kind of on your radar at all?
Yeah, I'm aware of it and I'd like to know more about it.
Yeah.
But more time constrained that I didn't dive into it that much. But that's one of the things that I like, and especially also formal verification. That was also a big subject at the security summit before ETC. So yeah, I think that's pretty interesting, and yeah, also fuzzing by the way, because I think it can complement the human review quite good. So it comes from a different angle.
Mm.
As we all know, with the Swiss cheese approach, you need as many angles as possible to get a good result.
Yeah, for sure. And what do you think is kind of missing from the automated space right now that's allowing auditors to keep their jobs?
Well, what I think is missing, but it's more in general as a Web3 space, that's a good solid standard. So yeah, you can call it like a checklist how things are supposed to be, but then it should be like a very clever checklist which goes very deep on all subjects. So mm-hmm. That's in the traditional audit. So that's like the very first thing that a traditional auditor learns. So where is the standard? Well, how is it supposed to be? Well, in the Web3 space, that's largely missing. So there are a couple of attempts for that. But yeah, it's not super complete. And certainly most people don't use it. So I think if those standards would be there, then that would also be super helpful for tools and formal verification and fuzzing and whatever.
So the main thing is that these protocols don't have standards that you're kind of comparing to, like what the code is versus what they're saying it should be, right?
Yeah, I'm more thinking about sort of general standards. So if you have like an AMM, it should at least have this, and this.
Yeah, I guess it's quite hard since everything has their own unique quirks and differences between each other. They might implement, you know, a line of code that just changes everything, and something depends on that, it just spirals out of control.
Yeah. I did several attempts to start with it, but usually then I get stuck in the complexity. Making a high-level standard is not that difficult, but it's also not that useful. But once you go more into the details, it gets super complicated.
Yeah, it's more of a complexity issue when automating this, because there's just so many possibilities when even in the contract, so what paths you can take, but then also the sequences of these paths you can take. And if you account for call data and arbitrary addresses, then you have to create an arbitrary contract with arbitrary sequences of functions which interact with this. So it's like a massive complexity issue of, you know, what's possible. And it's more about how fast it is as well. If you don't have enough time to just sit there and wait to solve every possibility that can happen in this one contract, because then you're not going to get anywhere in the long term because there's so many contracts out there. And so imagine performing that in every single contract out there. So I wonder what your kind of perspective is on the future of Web3 security and what's going to happen in the coming years.
I think, well, the security itself has to improve quite a lot because there's still so many hacks that it's not really sustainable. So
mm-hmm.
Something has to be improved. So yeah, at least tools probably will help with that. humans cannot improve all that much. That improvement has to come from the tools. But for tools currently, it's quite difficult to find that the really high-risk stuff. So they're quite good, I think, at relatively low-risk stuff.
Yeah, but once it's deployed, the lower-risk stuff doesn't really matter. The only thing that matters is the high stuff, because you have all these millions of dollars on these protocols, and if someone is able to build something that can take all that money out, then all the mediums and lows don't really matter too much.
Well, it would help if you would systematically, every new high-risk exploit that has been there, if you could somehow make a detector or whatever out of that and apply that for every future contract, and if you could just keep doing that, then the probability of the same hack happening again will get lower and lower.
Yeah, but I guess the context of each contract is quite different as well, though. And there's also like a fuzzing side of these sequences, but then you also have another fuzzing side of the actors and their states in the contract and the contract state as well. So I think it's really quite hard.
Yeah, I think also in general, the entire space, the contracts, it's all getting more and more and more complicated. So spread over multiple chains and connecting a lot of stuff, and the crown account abstraction stuff added on top of it. Connection to the real world, IoT devices, whatever. So it's getting more and more and more complex.
Yeah, like the off-chain kind of stuff as well. You have to account for that. And kind of like GMX, I guess, how they have the off-chain order book. And now even Uniswap has an off-chain order book, I think, with Uniswap X. So you're going to have to account for all that stuff and just different positions, for example, and liquidity pools. I think the automation side is quite interesting because it's such a hard problem. And so it'll keep you busy for a long time.
Yeah. It will be challenging for new security reviewers and auditors who come into the space. I think it must be overwhelming for them now. So with all my experience, I still can barely keep up. So for new people, it must be impossible.
Yeah, I can imagine. If you were new as well, what would you kind of take to get to the point where you are now in an accelerated way, now that you have all this experience and you kind of know the journey? So
yeah, I think basically, first try to learn as much as possible about Solidity, the EVM, so the basics. So luckily there are now lots of resources online.
Mm-hmm.
And then create a couple of POCs and whatever, so that you have some sort of hands-on experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
So write a little bit of Solidity and then start participating in Code Arena or something.
Mm.
And just do your very best to fully understand the contracts and then really spend a lot of time on it. So a full week. So I know people usually have their old jobs, so it's difficult to spend a lot of time on them. But if you're really serious, then I'd say, well, take off a week or two or whatever and just spend a really lot of time on a project and try to find as much as possible. And submit it at Code Arena, and then wait until the report is final, and then see what you've missed, and then try to understand what you've missed, why you've missed it, and then learn from that, and then repeat doing that.
Mm. I think the CTFs are quite good as well, because there was even a time, well, not just a time, but the CTFs correlate pretty well with these hacks as well. Maybe just not as complex because of the code base size, but the fundamental pathway, it definitely is similar.
Yeah, that also helps. But myself, I don't really like CTFs all that much, so I hardly ever do them. But I think it's good to get experience with real projects, just also to get the feeling of real projects and interacting with the project, asking the questions, see what answers that you get that way. And then finally, when you're a little bit further advanced, you can do all this with a team. So in combination with more senior people and just see what they're doing and try to copy that.
Yeah, and a major part of these audits are the report writing as well. So how do you approach building a high quality report that kind of ensures people want to come back to you?
Yeah, well, that's where I'm lucky, because at my previous role as an IT auditor, I was very well trained in writing reports. So they had to be really super good. So I've got some experience over there, so that helps.
Yeah.
But in general, I think when you write up an issue, it has to be like super clear. And also with some code examples where you really point, well, this piece of code, there is something is happening. And then not a code of 200 lines, but restrict it to maybe the 10 most important lines. And then point out what's happening and explain.
There have been points where I was reading some reports and it's just like mass blocks of just code. It may as well just put the contract in there itself. And it's just like you skip over that because it's so much.
Yeah, what I usually do, I copy paste the function text and then I delete everything and replace it by dot, dot, dot. Everything that's not important for the issue I'm trying to make. So then usually you can reduce it to whatever, like 10, 15 lines at the most.
And since you were trained, what was the main things apart from obviously making the code concise and telling the severity where it is? What other kind of things did you learn that you wouldn't think you would pick up if you were just reading other people's reports in like C4, for example?
Yeah, of course, structuring your text is very important. So not enormous blobs of text, but headers within it. So you have to keep in mind like the reader. So imagine that the reader has only like maybe 10 seconds to glance over your report or over your issue.
Mm.
So in 10 seconds, he has to understand more or less what it's about and whether it's important or not.
Mm. Okay, I've got you. What's the kind of layout you provide to ensure that 10-second understanding?
Yeah, so it's basically like a title and then the description of what the problem is in a short number of lines. Then
right.
A description of what the risk is, so why it is a problem and what could happen if this occurs. And that part is really important. So you have to explain that to the receiving end because that's what triggers them. So if that says, well, all funds can be stolen, then you immediately have their attention. But it has to be true, of course. You for sure should not exaggerate.
Mm-hmm.
So write it up as it is, but also write down the worst possible thing that can happen.
Okay. Yeah.
And then a piece of code to really show where it's going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, a solution on how it can be fixed. And then preferably also with a piece of code. And preferably with a delta, with the minus this line and plus the other line. So that is really clear how to fix it.
Yeah, I agree. You got to kind of convey it to someone, even if they're not a developer as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a manager should also be able to read it. So maybe not understand the details of the code,
yeah,
but at least a couple of lines about what's the problem and why is it a problem.
Because I assume these managers and CEOs would hire you for audits and not always developers, right?
Yeah, it's usually not the developers that are taking the decisions to do that. So it's always somebody higher up in the organization.
Mm-hmm. And what is the kind of process of giving the report and what happens after that? They just pay you or do they have like conversations, asking you questions, feedback? How does that kind of go about?
Well, it's usually before the final report is there. So what we usually do at Spearbit, but I guess others are doing that, could be doing that too. So in GitHub, we actually prepare the report by making all the issue descriptions like I just explained and put that in GitHub issues. So basically the entire text of the report is there except from the intro and the conclusion and the main conclusion.
Mm.
And then we have a call with the project team and we go through the issues and then mainly the high risk issues. So to explain all those issues and make sure that they at least, so that they understand what the issue is and what would be the way to approach it.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards they start fixing it. And then sometimes they ask questions if it's not clear or whatever. And then after they fixed it, then we review the fix to make sure that nothing else is broken by the fix. And then finally we double check all the fixes and sign and mark them that is fixed. And then all of that together is put in the report.
Mm.
So that's more or less the approach.
Mm-hmm. How do you kind of like know when to stop auditing, I guess? Because obviously you can have like a massive code base, just like 10 contracts or something, just giant code base. And then you also have, you know, the smaller code bases. So what's different about auditing both of them? And how do you kind of adhere to the time constraints you're given?
Yeah, well, so before you start, usually you try to scope how long it will take. So this helps a little bit experience, but it could be maybe 1 week or 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. Of course, the bigger the code base, the longer it will take. The idea is that, yeah, you should have enough time to do it well, but also not too much time because it would be too expensive for the project. So you hope to fit it at exactly the right amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the audit, I keep in mind that detailing the issues will take maybe 1/3 of the time. So the first 2/3 of the time is basically this understanding the code and writing comments and collecting comments and that kind of stuff. And the last 1/3 is combining all comments and issues and writing the really detailed descriptions about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, I sort of know when it's finished, if I read through everything, I understand everything and double checked it yet another time, and I no longer can find any new stuff, then I know that at least I cannot find anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the scoping wasn't right, so you don't have enough time. So then it's the best to do is to talk with the project and say, well, if we really want to do it thoroughly, we need a bit more time.
Right.
And so let them choose to either keep it time boxed so that it's maybe 100% thorough, or maybe extend the time so that it's really thorough. And most of the time, actually, they do want to extend the time. Assuming that, of course, you're serious, and because the project also looks along with in the GitHub, so they know what's going on, and that convinces them that you're indeed serious and not just saying it, we just want more money.
Yeah, got you. And obviously, when you find things that you're suspicious of, how do you go about writing, you know, a working proof of concept that you can execute and prove to them? Because the contract might not be initialized, right? It might not have any tests already, so you have to initialize it yourself. So how do you kind of go about writing a working POC for these?
Yeah, usually I try to reduce the code. So usually I take the relevant functions out of the code and copy that, and then make a POC out of that. But it also helps to make the issue clearer and to really understand what's going on.
What would the most relevant code be? It's just kind of like the storage interactions, what functions are being called, right?
Yeah, it sort of depends on where the issue is. For example, if there's a function with a missing modifier or something, you could just copy that function and make a small fork out of that. Or sometimes it's a something in the calculations or a math error or whatever, and then you just take the parts that are involved in that math and simplify it as much as possible to show the issue.
And then you just try and initialize it all. Even that would take a little bit because you have to manual fuzz the initialization. For example, if it's a Uniswap pool, and something requires a Uniswap pool at a specific liquidity amount, then you have to set up, you know, the tokens to create the pool. And let's say the factory is not even deployed, so you have to deploy the factory, you know, all that stuff, and then get to the specification it requires to, you know, actually run the proof of concept. What's like the most efficient path you take to get that working?
Yeah, then I would basically do, for example, skip the factory part and only take the real important stuff, and also reduce those functions where possible.
Okay.
To make it really as small as possible.
Got you. And then would you deploy it as well on, I guess, like a testnet or just locally?
Yeah, usually just locally. Sometimes on a fork, if it's a more complicated fork, preferably if possible just locally.
And you're writing comments basically on every single line of this proof of concept as well. It's not just like the code block or...
Yeah, then I just explain what's going on. And for the highlights, I put some comments. But usually the POCs are also very small. Then you don't need that much text. And if it happens to be not clear for the project, then of course you can explain it a bit more. But most of the time, because it's so reduced, it's quite clear for them.
And in your experience working with Spearbit, the best of the best, and even in C4, what do you think differentiates someone as yourself to someone that's not finding all these highs and getting successful bounties?
Yeah, I guess it's basically like experience and intuition. So all the people I know that are doing really well, they also spend lots and lots of time on it, and they've done numerous projects and reviewed numerous contracts. So I think basically that's it, just lots of experience. And of course, also understanding all the details very well.
Yeah, and intuition is a massive thing as well for anybody that's elite in their field. You develop that over tons of experience, and it just becomes, you know, an easy way.
Also the most difficult to explain to others. So I don't know why I know it, but I know there's something wrong. I can't explain it why.
How do you go about your day as well to get into like a flow state and really get into the, you know, a very focused kind of state and not get distracted and have 100% energy in this? How do you kind of set yourself up for success really in a day-to-day?
Yeah, that's also quite important. So I do it full time. So from the beginning, I've always been doing it full time.
Right.
So that helps quite a lot. Well, the first thing is actually sleeping. So you have to make sure that you sleep really well. So basically this before, of course, the day. But I think that's by far the most important thing. So if you're sleeping, have slept well, well rested, then your mind is the most clear. For example, also the rule is I don't drink alcohol, because usually after I drank alcohol before, then the day after I'm a bit drowsy. So that doesn't really help. I drink a little bit coffee, but not too much. So a little bit coffee helps to get more focused, but too much coffee doesn't help. What I also do is frequently go outside. For example, after breakfast, after lunch, and after dinner, I always go outside to walk or ride my bike or do another sport. So it also helps to keep your energy up.
Yeah.
And what I also do is once a week do yoga. So yoga also helps to relax and to be flexible. So actually, I one time heard that yoga is very important to be able to sit an entire day behind your computer. So that's basically what most people like us are doing. And sitting is not super healthy, actually. And to be able to do that, it really helps to do yoga. So that's also something that I do.
Do you do like any kind of meditation as well to focus your mind?
No, not really meditation, but when I dive to the smart contracts, it's kind of a meditation basically, because I then have to get everything around and just focus on that. And
And how does your kind of setup look? So you limit distractions as much as possible and really get into that flow state and not be broken out of it.
Yeah. So I like to have a quiet environment. So a few weeks ago, they were building close to me and there was a lot of noise. Now, that doesn't help. So then I'm constantly distracted. So that's difficult to concentrate then. Sometimes I put up music just to hear, also to stay in the flow mindset and don't hear anything else. And the beginning of the day is very easy, quiet music. And then the further the day goes along, the more active the music gets.
And I guess, how do you stop from interacting with social media as well? Because that's a massive distraction, right? So how do you go about that and not get brought into it? Do you have like a specific setup you do, or you just don't have social media on any like laptop or something?
Well, I actually do social media quite a lot, but I do that mainly Twitter, by the way, sort of scanning Twitter to see all the interesting stuff. But I mainly do that whatever in the evening or during breaks or whatever.
Right. So how long do you spend on, let's say, a session of, is it a couple of hours, maybe like 30 minutes on, 10 minutes off, something like that?
Yeah, usually a couple of hours, and then I have a break to drink some tea or coffee, not too much coffee, and then another 1 or 2 hours, and then lunch, and then go outside for a while, and then another session like that. So yeah, something like that, and then go through the day.
For me, at least, no, I don't have, like, let's say, Discord or Telegram open specifically, not even in my hotbar. I still have the urge to just like type it in and open it. So I guess it's always like building great habits, right? And sticking to routine. Do you have like a specific routine you follow, whereas let's say you block out every 30 minutes of the day, or is it really just like a priority thing? I need to do this. Let's do this first before everything else. Doesn't matter the order or how much time it takes.
Yeah, well certainly the main routine that I do is go outside and walk or ride my bike. For example, after breakfast, that really helps to get awake and to have some sunshine. So then you're really awake, you forget everything around you. And so you maybe like 15, 20 minutes, so not that long. So that really helps. Oh, by the way, I also do now and then, especially if it's contracts with lots of information. So then maybe after 4 hours, then I got sort of like an information overload feeling, so that I've got a feeling when my head is kind of full with all that much knowledge. Then I take a power nap of like 15 minutes, and then somehow it's stored in my brain, and then I can, the feeling is gone, and then I can continue absorbing new information.
I used to have that as well, where I just like my brain, I would get like super sleepy after just thinking for so long, and then you just take a nap and it's like brand new. It's kind of
Sometimes it's more like sleepy, but more sometimes it's just that you have to think there's somehow too much in your head. So I can't really explain it, what it feels like, but I've got the feeling there's too much in my head now. I cannot fit in anything more. And after 15 minutes power nap, then there's space again.
Yeah, it's the same with me. If I'm just thinking too much, my head kind of gets like hot as well. I don't know what goes on there, but Maybe it's just
maybe we could like have a cooling ice packs on top.
Dip my head in some freezing water and I'll be fine. Yeah.
Cool down the motor.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, every day I drink like maybe 2 cups of green tea and then try and like, you know, have sun like shine on my face. That's how I get my day started. How do you get your day started? Like once you wake up, then what happens from there?
Yeah, usually I have some breakfast and check some social media. And then I go outside, ride my bike a little bit, go back. And then, if I'm doing other thing, usually I go into other thing and otherwise, whatever, investigate something interesting until, it's midday and I'm going to have lunch, then go outside again.
Yeah, so it seems quite balanced.
Yeah. Also, by the way, I have my alarm clock set at the same time every day of the week. So that also helps to stay in the rhythm.
Mm. Alarm clock for waking up or going to bed?
For waking up.
Okay, right. I actually met someone, Owen from Guardian Audits. He has an alarm clock for going to bed instead of waking up. And he wakes up naturally at the same time. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, that would be good. But having it at the same time, usually I'm right awake just before the alarm clock. So that your rhythm of your body kicks in then.
Yeah, the circadian rhythm. Yeah. Whenever I'm like in the zone, I always go over it. Like maybe I just fixed my sleep schedule, but then one day I get super focused and then like I go into maybe 4 a.m., 5 a.m. I just completely ruin my sleep schedule. Yeah, it's horrible. I don't know how to like fix it apart from an all-nighter or just go to bed early, take like a melatonin pill.
Yeah, in the meantime, I've realized if I go on too long, so basically after dinner, I don't really do anything really focused auditing type of stuff anymore. So yeah, just some social media, but not where I really have to think hard, because I know if I do that until late in the evening, then I have to pay that the next day because then my concentration is gone. I've really learned it that way, that's the best rhythm for me.
Yeah, unfortunately for me, mine's the opposite. I get more productive the later it becomes. My sleep schedule just gets completely annihilated from that. But basically, the more I'm getting tired, the more kind of focused I get, which is super weird. Like in the mornings, I have no ability to focus, but yeah, it's kind of odd.
Yeah, but everybody has to figure out his best rhythm. So it could be different for different people, of course.
We are getting close to 1 hour, so I don't want to keep your time, you know, captive for too long. But yeah, man, thank you so much for coming on. I hope you enjoyed this as your first kind of podcast. I'm sure.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about this. So,
Yeah. It's great to just expel what you're thinking. I know like people IRL don't really talk about this stuff. So it's great to just chat for, you know, a good time. But yeah, man, thank you so much for coming on. And I hope the listeners also enjoyed this as much as I did. I'm super excited to see what's going to happen in the future for you. Maybe you get into program analysis, get into the fuzzing.
Yeah, you never know. There's always interesting stuff.
Yeah, man. So if anybody else wants someone out, someone on the podcast, just message me on Twitter at scrapingbits or email me at scrapingbits@gmail.com. Otherwise, I'll see you in the next episode.